house today. Our argument today is twice as long as we usually grant. And the court did that because of the significance of the concerns and because the number of parties. I'm sure everybody had a good opportunity to argue to us. However, we will hear the first argument, which is 50 minutes, by Attorney Teslin. Then the court will take a 10-minute break, and then we will be back. That will give you all a chance to stretch, to yawn, and get all psyched up for when you begin on your part of the argument. So just tell you that in advance when the first argument is done, and we will be back, so don't wander too far away. If you need a break in this long an argument, we will be back in 10 minutes after we walk out the door, or the back here. Okay? Well, with that little announcement, I will call our last case of the day, Service Employees International Union, Local 1 versus Voss. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Misha Zaitlin for Legislative Defendants. The laws at issue here address the threats to the rights and liberties of Wisconsinites when the Attorney General settles away the state's interests, including in the validity of state law, and when unelected bureaucrats make decisions that affect the rights of Wisconsinites without oversight of elected representatives of the people. The laws here use well-established constitutional tools to achieve these ends. There are four categories of laws that I'd like to discuss today. First, there is a category of laws that permit the legislature to intervene to defend its enactments. The tools here are exactly the tools that the U.S. Supreme Court has said legislatures should adopt if they want to avoid the serious separation of powers problem that occurs when an attorney general concedes away the validity of state law. The second category of laws at issue here allow the legislature to approve settlements or compromises the attorney general may reach using a well-established co-equal seat at the table structure, which goes back to the state's founding. The third category of laws add five new committee review provisions, reviewing the decisions by administrative agencies, no different in substance or principle to the many dozens of such provisions that the legislature has adopted over the last 40 years in reliance on this court's decision in Martinez and the Court of Appeals decision in Oak Creek. And the last category of laws that are challenged here are garden variety regulations of the powers and duties of administrative agencies.
I want to take you to your second category. And that is where you talked about in these act provisions that allow for the legislative, what you characterize as approval of settlements. And what I'd like you to first answer for me is where exactly is this power in the legislature to, the way I read these statutes, is put a stop to settlements. Where is that authority when you talk about separation of powers? Because the legislature, as we both know, makes the laws, and the executive enforces them. So tell me how you get to basically put a stop, the legislature stops the ability of the executive to enforce the law. Where do you get that power?
Well, Your Honor, we are here facing a constitutional challenge. Of course, all laws enacted in the state are presumed to be constitutional. There's only one provision, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs cite to challenge the constitutionality of these provisions. And that's Article 5, Section 4 of the Wisconsin Constitution. That's the only provision that they cite to question the constitutionality of these provisions. This is a presumptively constitutional.
Understood, but we have something called the separation of powers, and even if we accept that this power does not lie exclusively within the executive function, these are shared powers, and I want to know where the power comes from the legislature to essentially put a stop to the executive function to settle these cases.
Well, again, Your Honor, the challenge here is only challenging a violation of Article 5, Section 4. That is the governor's power to execute the law. With respect, these provisions have absolutely no impact on the governor's power to execute the law. These provisions only amend Chapter 165, which impacts only the Attorney General's power. The Attorney General's power is not grounded at all in Article 5, Section 4, is grounded entirely in Article 6, Section 3. And that power is subject entirely to plenary legislative control.
Isn't that just the start of the analysis? So, yes, the legislature can deprive the Attorney General of the entirety of his authority and consign him to twiddling his thumbs all day long. However, that doesn't answer the question of where that power goes after it is withdrawn from the Attorney General, does it?
That's right, Your Honor, but I would submit that nothing in the Constitution speaks to that question.
Well, what about this? Don't we need to look at the nature of the power withdrawn from the Attorney General to determine where it could legitimately go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if the Attorney General had been exercising executive power, simply by virtue of the fact that the legislature had authorized the Attorney General to act in that capacity, does not mean that if they take away the authorization, that executive power would go to the legislature, correct?
Right, Your Honor. But the executive power in the state,
go ahead.
The executive power in the state is vested entirely in the governor under Article 5, Section 4. Whatever the Attorney General's power is, whatever one calls it, quasi-legislative, quasi-executive, it is emphatically not the executive power. Because if it was the executive power, then constitutionally speaking, the Attorney General would be the subordinate of the governor. Because under Article 5, Section 4, the only provision that they cite here, under Article 5, Section 1, and then it's carried over to Section 4, all of his executive power is vested in the governor, not the Attorney General. So under that thesis that somehow what the Attorney General is doing on Chapter 165 is executive, then the Attorney General would be the constitutional subordinate of the governor under the constitutional text.
All right, let's put a bookmark there. That's a good point. I don't want to get back to that. But then is it your position, then, that all of the authority that the Attorney General exercises is legislative authority?
No, Your Honor. What I think the Attorney General's authority is a hybrid function. I think the best description of this is in the Arnold Christensen seminal paper about the Attorney General. What Arnold Christensen says is the Attorney General is neither in the legislative branch nor the executive branch. He says it's hybrid, and he is the legal representative of both. That's what he says, and I think that is the best articulation of, for example, we are here today. The Attorney General is here. Attorney Pines is here for the governor, and I'm here for legislative defendants. I would submit that none of us today are engaged in the enterprise of executing the law. We are in the enterprise of litigation. I am speaking for the people's interests in the validity of state law, speaking on behalf of the legislature. And certainly what General Call will be doing here in the next half of this argument, and what Attorney Pines will be doing next half of our argument, is not executing the law in any respect.
Okay. So let me just make sure that I'm developing the correct paradigm within which to understand this. If the Attorney General does not exercise legislative power, and he does not exercise executive power, what kind of power is it?
It's called administrative. That's what our Constitution calls it. The Attorney General is his authority, unlike in the U.S. Constitution, is under a different article. It's under Article 6, which is under our Constitution called administrative. That is the kind of power.
Is that a fourth branch of government?
That under our Constitution, that is a fourth branch of government. In this Court's decision, this Court has not spoken about that fourth branch, but as a plain matter of constitutional text, there is no way to read Article 6 as another branch of government, because
we've never recognized a fourth branch of government. In fact, in a recent decision, the Gabler decision, we recognized three branches of government.
That's right, Your Honor. And in the main, the division of separation of powers under the Wisconsin Constitution is similar to the federal government. But in this way, it is textually quite different. There is a Article 6 in our Wisconsin Constitution that has absolutely, absolutely no analog in the federal Constitution. Article 6 sets off administrative. And in this Court's decision in Oak Creek, This court held, consistent with 100 years of precedent, that for those administrative officers, especially the Attorney General, those powers are entirely prescribed by the legislature. There's no analog like that at the U.S. Constitution.
Hans, I think it's very interesting that you bring up the U.S. Constitution. You know, during my research, I read one of many Supreme Court cases, and it referred to 28 U.S. Code 530D. Well, you know, I thought it was interesting that they referred to it, so I went and got the U.S. Code on my computer, and I read it. And what do you know? What is going on in this particular section? Why? The Attorney General must submit to Congress a report of any instance where the Attorney General is to refrain from enforcing or applying a federal statute on the grounds that it's unconstitutional. And it goes on and on in many provisions similar to what the legislature did here. I was surprised not to find it in anybody's brief, but maybe it's not relevant to our reasoning, but certainly when you look at constitutional authority, it brought a lot of questions to my mind. Can you address that at all?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the Attorney General did flag that particular provision in his brief. Mm-hmm. And what we pointed out in our reply brief is that their arguments, especially the arguments that say that litigating the validity of state law is exclusively the governor's function or the Attorney General, they go back and forth, would, if applied to the federal level, would render that provision unconstitutional. Now, I will say this for the Attorney General, unlike the governor's argument, the Attorney General comes pretty close to conceding that both the intervention provisions and the judicial review and the settlement review provisions are constitutional when they come to the category of settlement away of the validity of state law. Now, you know, maybe General Call will say something different here, but as I write his brief, it's pretty close to a concession that at least as applied to those very important core applications of these statutes, these provisions are constitutional.
In regard to those core applications, I have a question for you, and I couldn't find an answer when I was doing my research, and I had a law clerk looking for me over the lunch hour. If we think that almost everything of a particular provision is within the legislature's authority and does not violate a separation of powers provision in regard to the power of the Attorney General, do we have the authority to sever a part of a provision?
Right. I have a two-part answer, Your Honor. Okay. If what we had before, Your Honors, was an as-applied challenge by the plaintiffs that attacked some applications of these provisions,
okay,
then under Wisconsin Statute 990001. That's right,
I'm
Your Honor.
I'm familiar with as-applied, but this is facial.
Yeah, well, with regard to a facial challenge, the only disposition this court could issue would say that these laws survive a facial challenge because there are some constitutional applications.
Well,
There may be.
Let me tell you what my problem is.
Mm-hmm.
I agree the constitutional power of the Attorney General arises from statutory delegations. We've got a case that's talked about that particularly.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Constitution envisions that the legislature cannot take all powers away from the Attorney General, or the statement in the Constitution that the Attorney General shall have powers as provided by law would make no sense at all. So you can't take everything away from the Attorney General. There's got to be something that remains.
Well, Your Honor, I think I heard Justice Kelly articulate just a minute ago a contrary view, but I think that
there's seven of us. You got to convince.
Right. But my next point is that disagreement need not be adjudicated in this particular case. Even if Your Honors don't want to accept our broader argument, which is under Oak Creek, there is no constitutional analysis necessary.
I don't think Oak Creek ever lined that up with the statement in the Constitution that says that the Attorney General has powers provided by law. If you take everything away from him, then the result is the Attorney General has no power. Then it wouldn't be in the Constitution.
Right, Your Honor. So if Your Honor wants to reserve the question of what, if any, residual power the Attorney General has.
I'm just looking at what the legislature has done.
Right.
And my concern is there any part of what they've done that would take all powers from the Attorney General? That was why I asked you about severability.
Right, Your Honor. There is absolutely no provision here that goes anywhere close to taking away all of his powers.
But that's your argument, isn't it? Your argument is that the Constitution indicates that the powers are as prescribed and duties are as prescribed by law. Your argument is you do the prescribing, that is, the legislature does the prescribing, which in my mind, the Attorney General is elected by the people of this state to be an attorney. And yet it seems to me that the logical extension of your argument is that you can totally nullify that election by removing all powers from him.
Your Honor, we have two arguments. And I want to be very specific about this, if I may.
Okay.
We have two arguments. Our one argument would lead to that conclusion. We have another argument that does not at all depend upon the conclusion. If I may talk about that argument, because I understand that there is some discomfort on the bench, at least from some of the justices I'm hearing, that don't want to fully embrace our first argument. If I may turn to the second argument. The second argument is that the only thing that these statutes do is give the legislature a co-equal seat at the table in certain client-side decisions. They do not give the legislature a single attorney-side decision. In fact, since the state's founding...
If the legislature is the client, that would be the state, right?
The state is the client, and the legislature has a co-equal say for the state's interest.
So if the legislature in that setting is the state, who is the AG?
The AG is the lawyer for the state. And if I may,
okay,
since the state's...
Why would the legislature have to intervene in litigation? Ever.
Well, so the legislation gives the legislature two paths to protect its core interests, especially in the validity of state law. One path is the more direct one, is we get a seat at the table as a party. For example, in a case like League of Women Voters that this court heard last term, the Attorney General was not defending the state law. The governor was attacking the state law, and we had to intervene in order to, so that there would be an exposition in defense of the state law.
Okay, so with regard to that argument, your seat at the table argument is your best argument, in my mind. The problem I'm seeing is that you're asking for more than a seat. A seat is intervening, potentially, and I don't know what the opposing counsel is going to say about that. But certainly there are cases where you can intervene. But basically, with Section 30 and Section 26, what you're saying is not just can you intervene, but you can grind to a complete halt this any kind of litigation that the Attorney General is conducting, period. So the buck would stop with the legislature. That's not a seat at the table. That is, you are the one making that decision. And as Justice Kelly was referring to, that's power. That's power to enforce the law. Where did it come from? How did you get it?
Well, Your Honor, so since the state's founding, when the Attorney General wants to bring an action, which is a quintessential client-side decision, he's had, since the founding, had to get approval from either the legislature or the governor. That's a co-equal seat at the table that the legislature has had since 1848. This is just the other side of the coin, is when the Attorney General wants to give away the state's interest. And if I can give Your Honors two examples, one hypothetical and one real, I think it can show what this legislation is trying to accomplish. In the Allen case, The Attorney General defended Wisconsin's right to work law in the trial court, in the federal court of appeals. He petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court. Legislature would have had no reason to intervene. And then when it got to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Attorney General, on the eve of the U.S. Supreme Court considering whether to take the case to protect an important provision of the Wisconsin's right to work law, he entered into a settlement with the plaintiffs to basically lead to a permanent injunction blocking an important provision of Wisconsin's law, and it was dismissed from the Supreme Court's docket the same afternoon.
Oh, so what I hear is you didn't like that outcome. I still have not heard any piece of how you get to make that decision. When you look at the case law that you cited in Aaron, the difference between this and Aaron is the buck stopped with the governor there. There was a potential that the executive at the end of the day got the say. Here, you've taken the executive totally out of it.
Your Honor, this is really important, if I may.
Go ahead.
In a HERM, in order for a building to get built, the governor and the building commission had to agree. You needed a thumbs up from both.
At the end of the day, the way that worked was the legislature got a chance in that case to waive a provision, a bidding provision. But at the end of the day, it was the governor who got to approve or not approve that waiver. So the buck still stopped with the executive, who has the power to enforce the law.
Let me just have a minute to walk through the logic tree why that's not right. The object is, can a building be built? In order for a building to be built, the building commission, a legislative committee, and the governor had to agree. Same structure, can a settlement happen? Can our right to work law be given away at the U.S. Supreme Court? The AG has to agree, the legislature has to agree. If either of them disagree with both decisions, if the governor disagrees, there was no building. If the building commission agrees, there's no building. If the AG disagrees, there's no settlement. If the Joint Finance Committee disagrees, there's no settlement. The logical decision structure is the same. In fact, one could say that the power in Ahern was actually stronger for the legislature because it got to initiate the building contract. Here, if the Attorney General doesn't, let's say we wanted to settle away something. Let's say we looked at a case and we're like, we really want a settlement in that case. We really want to give away this case. We would have absolutely no way to force the Attorney General to come to us with a settlement. The Attorney General could litigate the case to the end. So he has that power. It is a co-equal seat at the table. And so I've talked about the Allen situation. And I think the Allen situation shows why intervention is just insufficient. Because, sure, if we knew from the beginning that the Attorney General wasn't going to defend the right to work law, we could have intervened from the beginning, assuming the federal court let us in. Because, of course, these provisions can only apply as a commonly requested to the federal court. But we didn't know that. And so here's another provision, another example. And this one comes directly from the Attorney General's brief. And this will show that whatever one thinks of this power, it is at least a hybrid power which the legislature has a say.
But you get a say.
Right, Your Honor. And so in the hypothetical that the Attorney General put in his brief, there is a lawsuit by a prisoner's rights organization against the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections decide, yes, the plaintiffs are correct. We should enter an injunction. And here I'm going to extrapolate a little bit. That the injunction is going to reorient our whole prison system and going to require the legislature to appropriate $10 million in order to comply with this new injunction that the Department of Corrections has instructed the Attorney General to accept. I would submit that that is much closer to the legislature's core powers than the DOCs or the governor or the attorney generals, because we'd have to appropriate that money. That's why, you know, my friends, the plaintiffs, you look at their brief. They keep talking about what other states have done, every decision of every other state. We found, just from a non-comprehensive search, about 6 or 7 other states that require legislative approval of certain settlements. Now, with candor, most of those approvals are at a certain dollar threshold. One is settlements over $250,000. Some of them are settlements over $1 million. But the principle is still the same. When you have a settlement that impacts the public fisc, the legislature is the one with the constitutional authority to appropriate that money. That is why not only Wisconsin, but states around the country have determined that it is logical and it is constitutional for the legislature to have a co-equal seat at the table, since it has to be the one signing the checks.
Counsel, is it your position that the legislature represents the state of Wisconsin as opposed to the Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin?
That's essentially what I was asking.
That's exactly
before.
It.
And if so, why even have the right to intervention? Because if you're intervening, you're the legislature.
And
which are you?
Answer Justice Ziegler's question, being informed by the recent United States Supreme Court case of the Virginia House of Delegates, which indicated that you have to look at who specifically the statutes give the authority to represent the state to. And in that case, the court determined that the House could not act on behalf of the state because Virginia law gave the exclusive power to represent the state to the Attorney General. Ziegler was asking.
There's two different questions.
Okay, Ann.
When the legislature intervenes, and let's say the governor is in the case and the attorney general is in the case or one or the other, then the voice of the state is divided. We both speak for the state, but neither of us speak exclusively state for the state. That's what's happening here today. That's what happened in League of Women Voters.
Does Section 3 or 5, show me the text of Section 3 or Section 5 that allows you as the legislature to represent the state. As I read it, it allows you to intervene as the legislature, but it doesn't allow you to represent the state. Now, we have statutes, of course, that specifically state that is the Attorney General who will represent the state. Show me the text of what you're relying on, that you represent the state.
Your Honor, the state, we don't exclusively represent the state, it's true. The state's representation is divided. You know, for example, in this
case... Show me the text that says the legislature represents the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, well, when the... For example, Your Honor, in the Koshki case, when this court determined that the Attorney General couldn't speak on behalf of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Attorney General then went ahead and filed an amicus brief. You know, the state was divided in that case. It's certainly true that there is no provision that allows the legislature to speak exclusively as a state.
Is there any provision that says the legislature can speak for the state, whether exclusively or non-exclusively? Show me the text.
Your Honor, my point is that when the legislature is in court, the legislature is a part of the state. The legislature is saying, like, for example, today, here, everyone recognizes that the people have a...
Show me the text.
Your Honor, so if I may, everyone recognizes that the people have a right to have their voice heard in the defense of their state law. Here today, I'm speaking for that interest. Of course, my client is the legislative defendants. General Call is speaking. Attorney Pines is speaking. We are all, in a sense, speaking for the state. We are speaking for different actors in the state. Now, with regard to your question, Justice Ziegler, which Justice Bradley piggybacked on, in the Section 26 and 30 situation, we are sharing a seat at the table in client-side decisions for the state. Just like, since the state's founding, when the Attorney General wants to file, say, a federal court action on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, he's got to get a sign-off from either the legislature or the governor. And so we work together to make that client-side decision.
So when you say that you're the client, meaning you're the state, you're part of a client?
Yes, we are part of the client. The client has a decision. The client has a decision-making structure where you basically need two parties, two government bodies or officials to agree. This is not strange. This has been the case since the state's founding. Again, in order to file a federal court action,
so
the attorney...
Does the legislation that's at issue make you part of a client or the entirety of the client?
No, we have a co-equal seat at the table with the Attorney General. We can't force the attorney... Under the Wisconsin ethical rules of lawyers...
Well, lawyer-client relationship, do you think that's a co-equal?
No, Your Honor. So, the attorney, it's a hybrid situation. The attorney general is the lawyer. But he also has, in this hybrid situation, a co-equal say for the client. So, he's got certain ethical duties as a lawyer, and under this court's rules, a lawyer has to take the client's directions in making certain decisions whether to settle the case. Under the pre-existing law, the Attorney General got to be both, at least in defense side cases, the Attorney General got to be the attorney and fully the client. He got to decide the litigation decisions, and then he also got to decide the client decisions in defense side cases. In prosecution side cases, he was the lawyer, but then he shared with the governor a co-equal role to make client-side decisions.
Counsel, I want to ask about two different things I want to inquire about. The first is, obviously, we have two different sets of claims here, one on a motion to dismiss and the other the temporary injunction. Your brief really did not, actually, none of the briefs really addressed much of the substance of the numerous provisions that have been challenged that were not dismissed. You know, things like the enterprise zones, capital security procedures, all of that. And I'm wondering how you'd like us to handle those kinds of claims that are theoretically before us on a motion to dismiss. We took the case, but we don't really have arguments from either side on those issues.
With respect, Your Honor, I think that the arguments about the meaning of Martinez and Ahern fully cover the complaint's allegations on those. The theory underlying the complaint is that the legislature cannot block decisions made by administrative agencies unless it goes through bicameralism and presentment. If Your Honor accepts our purely legal submission that under Ahern and Martinez, a joint committee of the legislature does not need to go through bicameralism and presentment when it oversees executive agencies, then that is the entire substance of their claims, and they would need to be dismissed for those purely legal reasons. There's no other arguments in their complaint about other ways that this could be defective. Their entire argument is just the purely legal argument on what the meaning of Martinez and Ahern truly are.
I want to go back to your first argument, your sort of big picture argument about the Attorney General and his constitutional role. Is it your view, you described the Attorney General's role as administrative, is it your view that the legislature could carry on any administrative authority itself?
That is certainly a difficult question. If this court ever faced a situation where the legislature took all of the Attorney General's power and assign them to an independent body, all to the governor or to itself, I think the proper way to frame that case with respect would be to challenge that under Article 6, Section 3, and to ask this court to modify or make an addendum to Ahern. That would be the only way to do it. I think whatever one can say about that kind of situation, I think the one thing we can say is that would certainly not violate the governor's authority under Section 5, under Article 5, Section 4.
Well, let's talk about that, because really the Constitution lays out three different kinds of power that it vests. It vests supervisory and the supervision of public instruction, but it talks about three kinds of power. It does have a separate section for administrative, and the early commentators essentially talk about that as a subset of executive power. It talks about the executive power being vested in a governor. Surely that can't mean that the only people in state government that can exercise executive power is the governor. The only person who can exercise that is the governor. The U.S. Constitution vests executive power in the president, right? Surely there are all sorts of other executive officials who can exercise executive power, right?
Right, but putting independent agencies aside at the federal level, ultimately, if you just put Humphrey's executor and all those cases in that exception aside, ultimately at the federal level, because of the way the federal constitution is structured, that ultimately is the president's authority. If my friend's argument is correct, then the attorney general is under the supervision of the governor in the same way that the federal attorney general would be.
What does that provision mean then? It's a very common provision across other state constitutions. Many other state constitutions vest the executive power in their chief executive. They frame it exactly the same way. I think a number of these other states also have separately elected other officers doing traditionally executive type authority, like the superintendent, the secretary of state, those sorts of things. What is your view of the original public meaning of that provision of the Constitution? When it vests executive power in the governor, what do you think it's doing?
It is vesting the executive power, whatever that means. But I do think that we know that what it does not mean are the duties that are the attorney generals and the duties that are the secretary of states. For example, if one looks at at Article 6, there's a provision for the secretary of state. It says, and this is Section 2. It says, the secretary of state shall keep fair records of the official acts of the legislative and executive branches. If we read that provision in pari passu with Article 5, Section 3, we know that keeping the fair records of the official acts of the legislative and executive branch is not the executive power, because this power is vested in the Secretary of State. All of the executive power is vested in the governor.
So do you think that, just to give you a more extreme hypothetical, and I think one of your friends on the opposing side made this argument more or less, but do you think the legislative branch can take all administrative power and exercise it? So, for example, could the legislature pass a law that reduces the Attorney General to only sitting on the Board of Public Lands, or what I think that's what his constitutional authority is, and then essentially grant to, say, the Speaker of the Assembly or the Majority Leader, President of the Senate, the power to conduct all litigation on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, can hire any attorneys that that individual sees fit, and conduct litigation as he or she might see fit.
So, Your Honor, I have two answers to that question. It's very important that the Court understand my answers to both. First, as I read this Court's decision in Oak Creek, and I could see someone disagreeing, that that is what Oak Creek means, that that wouldn't violate any separation of powers principle because the governor's, the attorney general's power are not grounded in the Constitution. But if your honors disagree with that, there's no reason to decide that very extreme hypothetical here, because the decision-making structure that the legislature set out here is exactly the same with respect as the one in Ahern, which is that even if we were to say that this is an executive power, and we do not think it is, but let's say, arguendo, that this is an executive power. In Ahern, the Court of Appeals, in a decision that is statewide binding effect, said that the power there was beyond dispute an executive function. And it said that if the executive branch can check the commission's exercise of that executive power, there is no separation of powers violation.
And how can they check it here? That's the point I've been trying to ask you over again, is that this, in this case, at the end of the day, it was the governor, it was the executive that got the final say. That was the check on the power. That's what Aaron says. So how is this a check when you can shut down, totally shut down what the Attorney General is doing with no ability for the executive to then have the final say?
Well, again, I don't want to repeat myself, but I think it's very clear that what you're saying there is not right with regard to Ahern. In order for a building to be built, both the governor and the building commission had to agree, right?
You're talking about the initial taking of the case. I'm talking about shutting down something that is in the purview of the executive branch.
Your Honor, in Ahern, they said that building contracts was in the purview of the executive branch. And yet, because there was a co-equal seat at the table between the governor and the building commission, that was okay. Let's say, arguendo, that entering into a settlement, settling away a law that the Wisconsin legislature has enacted, is in the purview of the executive in the way that building a building
was. So the legislature can have a say. They can have a say. But who decides?
They would both have to agree, just like they had to both agree in Ahern. Again, if the... You know, let me try this one more time, and then I will attempt to move on to another argument. If there was a building that was wanted to be built, the building commission and the governor had to agree, right? If there is a settlement that the Attorney General wants and we agree, there's a settlement. If there's a settlement that we want and the Attorney General doesn't, there is no settlement. The structure is identical to Ahern.
Counsel, if I may, one of the problems, the foundation of your argument is that, look at this. Article 6 is entitled administrative. And, of course, the Attorney General comes under Article 6, as well as the Secretary of State and others. And you're advancing that because it is headed administrative, the Attorney General has no executive powers. Is that what I hear you saying?
That's right, Your Honor. I understand Your Honor joined the dissent in Oak Creek.
Well, I want you then to look. You know, we often deal with the big picture, the Attorney Generals and the Secretary of States, but I like to talk about the small picture. What about the counties? And, of course, the counties. And, of course, Article 6 also talks about county officers. And it speaks of the chief executive officer, right? So your argument is saying, really, because the chief executive officer is under a heading of administrative, that the chief executive officer in a county is not executive. Isn't that what you're saying?
No, let me refine some of what I'm saying is very important. What I'm saying that...
How do you deal with the language of chief executive officer in the Constitution?
Right, Your Honor. If Your Honor will let me finish, I think you'll hopefully be satisfied with my answer. When I say that what the Attorney General is doing is not the executive power of the state, what I'm saying is it's not the executive power as that term is used in Article 5, Section 1 and Article 5, Section 4. If it is in some respect executive beyond that, that doesn't have any constitutional import. They have brought, and I would urge your honors to look at the Governor's Appendix 33. Their only source of their complaint, the only constitutional violation that they urge here, is a violation of the governor's power to execute the law. They have never alleged that the Attorney General has some Article 6, Section 3 power to execute the law as the counties might have. So I would submit that their entire lawsuit is a misnomer. If they think that the Attorney General has some executive power and it's different than the executive power in Article 5, Section 4, they should bring that kind of lawsuit. If they bring that kind of lawsuit, then this court would have to confront the issue of whether that is consistent with the constitutional text, whether that is consistent with Oak Creek, whether that's consistent with all of the cases that Oak Creek cite. But again, I would ask your honors to look at their complaint. It doesn't say, not a word of it says, that there is an executive power vested under Article 6, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution.
Counsel,
what they say...
You've got about 10 minutes left in your argument, and I'm wondering if there are no further... if we don't want to pursue this too much further right now, if we could turn our conversation to guidance documents. And I want to set up a couple of things here real quickly. A guidance document is something that does not have the force of law, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So it is the governor's it's him talking about the law. It's not the law itself, right?
With respect, what you said is very important that I correct.
Okay.
The guidance document provisions do not apply to the governor. Chapter 227 specifically exempts the governor and his office for exactly the reason that you're getting at. It only applies to the agencies.
All right. So there's a further predicate then that I need to set up. So traditionally we understand the administrative agencies exercising a combination of legislative, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So so we talk about the administrative agencies exercising legislative authority when they're prescribing things that have the rule of law, or they have the force of law, right?
I think that regardless of whether they're doing that or they're doing the other thing, they're doing a mix. Regardless, I think everything administrative agencies do is a mixed power. Because if what you were saying is correct, if they were doing purely legislative when they were doing rules, then Martinez wouldn't have engaged in a mixed power analysis. They would have just said that's purely legislative, the case is over. So I think that what this court's precedents stand for correctly is that everything executive agencies do are a mix of legislative and executive.
But doesn't that beg the question of whether we need to separate that out for purposes of separation of powers analysis?
Well, certainly this court in Martinez didn't separate that out, and the Court of Appeals in Ahern didn't separate that out. What they said is a very sensible rule. There were no administrative agencies at the founding, and so administrative agencies are creatures of the legislature.
What?
And so they're a hybrid situation. Everything that, sorry.
Yeah. So so the legislature, they create the administrative agency.
That's right.
Okay. Now the administrative agency is acting in a particular way, and it might be doing something that's legislative in nature, or it might be doing something executive in nature, right? So administrative agencies, quite often, they are the enforcement agencies for the administrative rules, yes?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. And when it's doing that, it's exercising executive authority, yes?
In the main, yes.
Okay. So so not everything that administrative agency does is the exercise of legislative authority.
I would say that it's all mixed, but I would say even further, it doesn't actually matter because the only thing the legislature has done here is taken away some responsibilities and given some new responsibilities. Legislature isn't involved in the, the legislature is not issuing guidance documents or anything like that. The legislature is told the agencies, which it could tell not to issue any guidance documents at all, that you have to follow certain procedures when you do.
Yeah, so for me at least, the question is, when an administrative agency creates a guidance document, what is the nature of the authority it is exercising to create that document? Can you tell me?
I think it is mixed, because of course it is mixed between legislative and executive. Because
what's the legislative piece of that?
Well, because the actual rules that would have the force of law.
Okay, but when
you have a guidance document,
yeah.
You're telling the regulated public how you're going to enforce those rules.
Right, and, but the regulated public can't be found in violation of the guidance document.
Well, right, but the fact of the matter is that what an agency says it will do has very important impacts on primary conduct.
Well, sure, because that's the discretion to enforce the law,
well, right,
which is an authority that belongs to the executive.
Right, Your Honor, and this is why I think it's mixed, because the discretion to enforce the law is ultimately a delegated legislative function, because the legislature could spell out...
Whoa. The authority to enforce the law is a delegated legislative function?
No, the room that an agency has within what the legislature has prescribed. The legislature could, for example, set out every single statute in such copious detail that a guidance document would be entirely unnecessary. It could spell out every jot and tittle of every single thing it's going to do.
Yeah.
And when legislature obviously doesn't do that, when it delegates, and I know some justices on this court are uncomfortable with delegation, when it delegates some authority that gives the agency some room to maneuver,
right.
Then they develop
a rule.
Right. Or they enforce it on a day-to-day basis in various ways. The delta of the room that the agency has, whether it's through a rule or through day-to-day enforcement or through guidance documents that will say how they'll do the day-to-day enforcement, that delta, that amount of delegation of legislative power is the excessive legislative power, which is why ultimately guidance documents are a hybrid situation. Just like, because rules are not law. And so they are hybrid. Guidance documents are not rules. They're also hybrid.
Wait, hang on a second. Now, rules do have the force of law, yeah?
But they are not law. That's why Martinez...
Okay, so hang on to that for a second. Someone could be found in violation of a rule, yes?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
And you could be fined or suffer some other penalty, yes?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If that's not a law, what is it?
Well, Your Honor, this is why I think some justices of this court have trouble with delegated authority and with the notion that agencies have this kind of... And because it is so constitutionally tricky, because it doesn't fit neatly into either box, rather than saying, as some justices in this court might want to say, that that's it, there's no rules, no leeway for agencies at all, this court has blessed a hybrid situation in Martinez. It has said that... Look, they didn't say this exactly, but I think what's in the backdrop of Martinez and Ahern is that administrative agencies, whether they're for guidance documents or for rules, weren't around at the founding. There are administrative agencies now. And since we have this kind of hybrid situation where you have fifth branch, I would say, of the government that has this kind of hybrid situation, we're going to apply a mixed power analysis to every regulation.
Back up for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really troubled by the idea that somebody could be penalized for violating something that's not the law. How do I square that? How do I make that work?
I think that is the puzzle that this court is going to have to grapple with if it deals with the non-delegation doctrine.
Do you have any guideposts we could follow in resolving that?
Well, I mean, with candor, I think the courts since the 1930s have gone very far from the constitutional core of that the legislature should be writing the law. But, you know, look, we're in that world. We're in the post-1930 world. I think it will be, with candor, impossible to... unless one were to actually overrule those cases and declare the administrative state unconstitutional, to actually return us to an originalist frame of mind when it comes to administrative agencies. So I think what this court did in Martinez was quite farsighted and wise. It said that, you know, we've got these administrative agencies. This court called them non-elected agency bureaucrats. These are the kinds of people who make these rules that someone could be put in jail for violating. And for those people, in this post-1930s world, we're going to allow a hybrid situation. We're going to allow the administrative agencies to be checked by this joint committee process.
Counsel, this is a facial challenge to these guidance to guidance document provision, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So give us the most innocuous example or two of a guidance document that doesn't offend anybody or burden anybody that would clearly pass muster. And obviously your opposing counsel need to show that that's unconstitutional under every situation, right? So give us an example or two of the most innocuous guidance document that exists.
Right. So the Department of Transportation puts out a handbook about how it's going to administer voter ID. It explains what people need to do, which people are eligible for to get free voter ID. You know how much in advance you've got to show up. You get the voter ID receipt versus the card and all that stuff, so that people know.
How
and
about stop at stop signs? That might be more innocuous.
I don't know that the Department of Transportation administers traffic laws, which that would take it out, but certainly the Department of Transportation does administer voter ID under the statutes. And so that would be pretty innocuous. And their entire challenge here is that this is so burdensome that the agencies are going to grind to a halt. Surely putting that document on the DOT's website for 21 days, getting some public input, wouldn't burden any agency any meaningful respect.
And the governor, by the way, I read in the statutes, if I understood it correctly, that the governor can actually reduce that time frame, correct?
That's right.
So theoretically, under the law, the most maybe the least, I don't know if it can reduce it to zero. That's maybe another question. But hypothetically, if there's something urgent, maybe there could be a day notice and comment period, and then it could go out. Is that fair?
Well, if your honors do want to take judicial notice of government websites, in fact, the governor has reduced some of the guidance document days to zero. Now, I know that there might be disagreement about whether the court wants to take judicial notice of government websites, but there have been some guidance documents in the wake of this court's state decision that the governor has, in fact, reduced to zero the number of days.
What about Section 64 that allows essentially suspension of administrative rules indefinitely without formal bicameral enactment process coupled with executive action that was required in Martinez? How do you get around that?
My reading of Martinez is that while there was bicameralism presentment there, that wasn't necessary to this. And the reason that one knows that is that this court positively cited three times the Ahern decision. In the Ahern decision, there was no bicameralism or presentment for the building commission to take its actions.
So yep. Saying only the formal bicameral enactment process coupled with executive action can make permanent a rule suspension. The word only there doesn't mean
that with respect, if Your Honor read that opinion, that's just an objective description of the law there. There is nowhere that the court is saying that that is constitutionally mandated. In fact, at the end of the opinion, when the court actually articulates the standards, what it says is you just need safeguards. It doesn't say that the safeguards need to be by cameras and assessment. I see my red light is on.
Yes, right. Thank you very much. Oh, that hour went by, or 15 minutes went by really fast. Okay, so we are going to take a 10-minute break. We will be right back. You can stand up, stretch a little bit, or take a break yourself if you need to. Come back, and Attorney Call, you are up next.
excuse me.
Do you have my sheet off, everybody?
Please be seated. Thank you. Okay, we will now hear from the Attorney General. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Justice Rogensack, and may it please the Court, in his dissent in Morrison versus Olson, Justice Scalia wrote, "The framers viewed the principle of separation of powers as the absolutely central guarantee of a just government." And that is the constitutional principle that's at issue in this case.
Can I just ask you, where do you fit? Are you executive, legislative, you're not judicial? Where are you? I don't know.
The Attorney General is an executive branch officer, Your Honor. First, I should clarify that as all of American history has shown, there are three branches of government and three types of governmental powers. This Court, through multiple decisions, has described the Attorney General as an executive branch officer and all of the officers in the administrative section as executive officers.
Here's how I see at least part of the analysis. With respect to where you fit is one part of it, and then we decide is it sole or shared. So if you can kind of weave that into what you're about to say, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. First of all, it is exclusively executive authority, other than with potentially some limited applications, which I'll return to. I would point out that in addition to county executives being in that article, district attorneys are in that article, sheriffs are in that article. Those are clearly executive agencies that enforce the law. That's a classic executive function. And in Chittenden, a 1906 state Supreme Court case, it referred to the Attorney General, the Secretary of State, and the Treasurer, together with the Governor and Lieutenant Governor, as heads of the executive department of the state elected by the people at large. In Schill, a much more recent case from 2010, the state Supreme Court referred to the AG's public records interpretations as executive branch interpretations. There are three branches of government. This Court has been very clear about that, and that is a central feature of the U.S. Constitution as well.
General, wanted to get your take on the argument that this is obviously a facial challenge. So there's, you know, lots of different permutations of the settlement, in particular the settlement authority issues here. But it seems in your brief that you more or less were comfortable with the idea that there could be some unique situations where the legislature might have a stake. Maybe it would be when the purse is implicated, the power of the purse, or spending money. Maybe it's in a situation where the governor and the attorney general refuse to defend a lawsuit and somebody steps in. And I'm wanting to know, I guess, more directly, do you concede that there is an appropriate situation where the legislature could give itself both powers of intervention and litigation? And if so, does that defeat the facial claim that's ultimately being litigated here?
The answer to your second question is no, and I want to talk about facial claims and also about the presumption of constitutionality conflict. But with respect to the point you're making about the limited circumstances in which these statutes may involve shared interests, first, it's important to note that 16508, Section 26 of the legislation, relates only to civil enforcement actions. So that statute in whole relates to the enforcement of the law. It's clearly unconstitutional in its entirety. Now, the part that modifies Section 16525 relates to defensive actions that the state is involved in. There, the vast majority of applications are one that are exclusive executive authority applications. There are two legislative interests lurking in the background, and Your Honor just pointed to the two of them: the power of the purse, the appropriation authority, and the legislature's interest in passing laws. So Chief Justice Rogensack pointed to a federal law that creates what would be a permissible structure for the legislature to get involved in a case. If the executive branch doesn't exercise its exclusive authority to represent the state in defense of a statute, that raises potential separation of powers issues. The U.S. Supreme Court in Windsor mentioned that. And there, the appropriate action is not for the legislature to control the actions of the executive. That is a classic violation of separation of powers. It is for the legislature to give itself a right to be heard and to intervene in the case.
Intervene.
That's not what this statute does, which is why it's unconstitutional in all of its applications.
But there's a right to intervene here that's granted to the legislature.
There is, Your Honor. And
both at appellate level and at the circuit court level.
That's right. And my fellow counsel's arguments focus more on the intervention than ours does. Our position, which we mentioned in a footnote, is that to the extent that the intervention provision replicates the constitutional infirmities of the litigation control authority, that it's unconstitutional. But to the extent that it does not, so to the extent that it allows intervention in that precise scenario, it would be appropriate. Likewise, with the power of the purse, Your Honor, the resolutions that we're talking about here are not ones that require an appropriation. If we were to enter into a settlement agreement that did require an appropriation, that would create a potential constitutional conflict. And had the legislature passed a statute that said there has to be legislation passed for the AG to enter into a settlement that requires an appropriation, that might be permissible. But that's not what the statute is. What happens now is the executive agencies, when there's an injunction imposed, they need to figure out how to make that injunction work with the resources that they have. Now, with respect to the question about the scope of the remedy, even if there were constitutional applications, the rule that a statute needs to be unconstitutional in all of its applications applies when private litigants are involved, and it's predicated on the concept of standing. An individual who's arguing the case that he or she is impacted in doesn't have standing to strike a statute beyond the reach of that case. So typically we don't strike a statute facially unless it's clearly unconstitutional. But here, every application of the statute involves the parties at issue in this case. Every application implicates the powers of the Attorney General or the powers of the executive branch agencies. So there is no standing issue here as to the applications.
Article 6 of the Wisconsin Constitution says the powers and duties of your office shall be prescribed by law. And Section 165 of the Wisconsin statutes gives your office the power to settle cases brought by the state, to compromise them. It is a statutory power, right?
That's right. The way that Justice Kelly described it before is exactly how I would have framed it. If
the legislature wants to
limit the Attorney General's authority to twiddling his thumbs and sitting on the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, under Oak Creek at least, that would be permissible. But what it cannot do is transfer executive branch authority to the legislative branch, any more than it could transfer the ability to prosecute cases from district attorneys who are also in Article
4. How does this statute transfer your authority aside from settlement and acting as the plaintiff? So you would be settling those cases where you were the plaintiff and you were defending cases where you were defending the state. But they focus only on claims that the statute is unconstitutional or that there's some other constitutional impairment. I don't see how that transfers an authority to the legislature rather than limiting the AG's authority.
Well, what the legislature's argument does is focus on those applications, but that's actually not what the statutes do. 165.08 is about civil enforcement actions prosecuted by the Department of Justice. Those aren't actions about defense of state statutes. Those are things like environmental enforcement cases, consumer protection enforcement actions, breach of contract enforcement actions. That is classic executive authority. On the defensive side, it applies to all cases involving claims for injunctive relief. So if somebody who's incarcerated wants access to a particular book, if that's injunctive relief, if somebody wants to be reinstated with their employer, if that's injunctive relief, this statute applies to it. So it sweeps far more broadly.
Doesn't it just involve plans that concede the unconstitutional or other invalidity of a statute facially or as applied?
That's one aspect of the statute, Your Honor, but this 165.25 applies to all claims for injunctive relief. That's Section 30 in Act 369.
Okay, and that's again, what I was just reading from, Section 30.
It applies to all claims for injunctive relief.
Right, but if one of those applications is constitutional, Doesn't that defeat the facial challenge?
It doesn't, Your Honor, and that's the point I was making in response to Justice.
I know, and I want to follow up on that because I didn't understand your answer.
The reason for
the facial challenge says there is no circumstance under which this law could be applied in a constitutionally compliant way, right?
That is how the facial doctrine is applied in cases involving private litigants.
Where do you find the distinction for private litigants?
So if you look at this court's decision in Gabler, for example, that was a case involving a judge who was having oversight imposed on him by the executive branch. Mm-hmm. But the court didn't just strike it down as to that judge, and it also didn't find that it was unconstitutional as applied outside of the context of judges, but it struck the statute down as applied to all judges, a facial remedy, because it was clearly unconstitutional in all those applications.
Yes.
But here the difference is all applications of this law apply to both parties. So there's no standing issue like you would have in most of those cases. And this court, I don't have the case in front of me, but this court has talked about the facial doctrine being cases that are beyond the reach of the parties. That's what applies. But the other issue, which goes to both the presumption of constitutionality
But that's not the point of the facial challenge. It's not a question of parties. It's a question of whether there is any way of salvaging the law in question, right?
But
if there is one way in which it could be applied constitutionally, we say the facial challenge must fail because there is some circumstance under which it could be applied constitutionally.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not correct. That's how it's normally applied because it is usually a private litigant. But here, every application applies, which is why it's not beyond the scope. And the other issue is relies on separation of powers.
Yeah. So this is an important point. So do you have a case that says the facial challenge does not apply unless you're dealing with individual parties?
Well, Gabler is a good example, Your Honor. Gabler
Read me the part of Gabler that says that.
Gabler is a statute that applied broadly, not just to judges.
I know.
But this court invalidated it as to all judges.
Yeah, but read me. Sure. So, but read me the part of Gabler that says this is the facial analysis applies only when you're dealing with specific parties, and it doesn't apply when all of the parties will always be implicated in the application of the statute. Read that part.
But Gabler goes beyond the individual case, though it doesn't strike down the statute in all of its applications. So it's an example of the point Your Honor is asking about.
Right. But this goes beyond the individual case, too. Right. You could have a case where, for example, a statute is being compromised away. Right. So we're looking at Section 26, and there's a proposed settlement. And it involves a concession of the unconstitutionality or the other invalidity of a law, right? That could happen in a particular case.
It's difficult to imagine how that happens in a civil enforcement action,
right? But that's what the Act says, yeah? So that could happen in a particular case. Now, perhaps more broadly, Article 26 applies also in situations in which there is no attempt to concede the unconstitutionality or other invalidity of a law. So you have a range of circumstances in which this law could be applied, and in one of them, it might be constitutionally applied in that way, and in others, perhaps not. Why does the facial analysis not apply under those circumstances?
First of all, and I apologize for not having the name of the case, but the language that's been used in discussing that doctrine is that when the relief requested reaches beyond the circumstances of the parties, that's where that facial doctrine applies, where it has to be proven unconstitutional in all of its applications. And here the relief we're requesting is not reaching beyond the circumstances of the parties. And the other...
The reason we speak in those terms, though, is because we're saying there is... There's no way of applying the statute constitutionally. So we look at the party in front of us and we say, well, it's not applied constitutionally there. And, oh, by the way, there is no one to whom this could apply constitutionally, right? It's not a question of the party who's in front of you. It's a question of the breadth of the unconstitutionality of the statute.
It's, It's about a judicial deference principle in not striking beyond the case and controversy that's before the court. Here, all applications are before the court. And the second point is there's no separation of powers deference due here because it is an interbranch conflict. Justice Scalia made that point in his dissent in Morrison versus Olson, where the court did not recite the presumption of constitutionality. When there are two branches in conflict, it would be to favor one branch to apply a presumption of constitutionality or to apply a deference standard that allowed for the statute only to be struck down in limited application.
That's a little bit of a different question, isn't it, the presumption of unconstitutionality? Here we're asking, is there a way of applying it constitutionally under any circumstances?
But
that's different.
But that's rooted in deference from the judicial branch to the legislative branch, which is not appropriate when the executive branch is in dispute with the legislative branch as to whether the statute is being applied constitutionally to the executive, Your Honor.
As a follow-up to Justice Kelly's questions, I read page 56 of your brief kind of going along with what maybe Justice Kelly is suggesting. You indicate there that the Joint Committee has not yet sought to suspend a rule more than once, and in the context of shared powers analysis, as clearly applies to agency rulemaking, etc. You end that paragraph with, this aspect of the case could be dismissed without prejudice, allowing any future actual and substantial encroachment on executive power by a legislative committee to be addressed at that time. Maybe I misinterpreted that provision, but I read that as saying, well, maybe it could be dismissed without prejudice for a future as-applied challenge.
I believe that's Mr. Saitlin's brief, Your Honor, but we believe that the statute is unconstitutional in all of its applications. The other point is there are no constitutional applications here because, again, had the legislature given itself a right to be heard and it acted independently but didn't substantially interfere with or impose a burden on the executive branch to litigate, that would be one thing, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a provision that allows the legislature to effectively affect the way that the executive branch is exercising its authority. I also just wanted to briefly speak to Ahern, which was one of the cases discussed before, and point out that that case is both readily distinguishable and it should be limited to its facts. It's distinguishable because that case involved building contracts, multi-year projects, which implicate the appropriation authority in future sessions. It's also distinguishable because it relates to a power that is much closer to a legislative power, the appropriation authority. But it should be limited to its facts because if you read that decision from 36 years ago, it doesn't read anything like this Court's recent decisions on the separation of powers. It talks about liberally construing the separation of powers. And what this Court has recognized in more recent decisions is that preserving the separation of powers was part of the genius of the founders when it comes to how we protect liberty and how we prevent tyranny.
Are you saying that the executive branch of Wisconsin government has the authority to declare a statute unconstitutional and advise you not to proceed further with litigation to defend that statute?
It does not have the authority to say that a statute is unconstitutional. It's one of the reasons that Mr. Saitlin's argument is a red herring, Your Honor. I can't settle a case such that a statute becomes unconstitutional. A statute only becomes unconstitutional if a court issues an order finding it unconstitutional. So if the legislature wants to be heard in a court proceeding, it absolutely, when it involves the constitution of a statute, it absolutely can seek to have its voice heard in that proceeding. But what it cannot do is force the executive branch to act in a particular way. That is what violates the separation of powers. So, again, had it created a statute like the federal system, where notice had to be given, that would have been appropriate. But that's not what this statute does.
Well, in the federal statute, the legislature, both the Senate and the Congress, get to intervene.
They get to be heard, Your Honor. And so if the legislature
here the statute grants the right to intervene, both at the circuit court level and at the Court of Appeals level, and are before us, I assume.
Well, so intervention when the executive branch is defending a statute, Your Honor, is different from intervention when the executive branch is not defending a statute. Because if that is an executive authority, generally speaking, to defend statutes and to administer the laws, if the executive branch is not exercising that function, as it would be if it were not defending the constitutionality.
Well, there's one provision under Section 97 where it talks about the constitutionality. Then it also says, or otherwise challenges the construction of any statute, which is, to me, very, very much broader than the other parameters. If I thought that section was constitutional, do I have the authority to strike out that provision? Can the court do something like that? I guess severability is the name that's usually applied to that.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, Gabler is the helpful example there. The Gabler acted categorically because it was the statute was unconstitutional as applied to judges, even though there was an individual judge before the court, and even though the statute would not have been unconstitutional as applied to executive branch officials. Likewise, here, to the extent that a statute is unconstitutional in part, the court can invalidate it to the extent of the unconstitutional.
That it's unconstitutional. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I will pass the rest of my time to co-counsel.
Okay.
May it please the court.
Before you start, Attorney Pines, I know you all have broken up the arguments a little bit. It might help us a little bit if you would tell us where we should try to focus our questions. Not that we'll behave and do that, but you could still tell us.
I am not making the argument just now. I'm about to introduce Matt Westland.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay. Well, the same will go for you when you get up and
may it please the court. I'm Lester Pines. I've been a member of the bar since 1975. Matt Wessler, or Gupta Wessler, in Washington, D.C., has appeared pro hoc vice. He is a member of the Bar of the District of Columbia.
Very good. Thank you. Well, welcome to Wisconsin in this nice, quiet court. As you can see, we're all very shy and ask very few questions.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rogan-Sack. May it please the court, Matt Wessler for the plaintiffs. And just to adhere to Your Honor's suggestion, I would like to focus on what I think is the second defect of a number of these provisions, which is the absence of bicameralism and presentment requirements. But before I do that, I do want to just circle back to what I think I heard from a number of justices during the first part of the argument, which was a question. Where in the text does the legislature have the authority to enforce the law? It seems to me a very basic question, but I don't think we heard an answer to it. And the reason we didn't hear an answer to it is because there is nowhere in the text of the Constitution that the founders of the Wisconsin Constitution or any other constitution gave the legislature that authority. The only authority that the legislature has is the authority to make the laws. And I think it's that key distinction that really explains why these laws run afoul of the basic separation of powers principles that have existed in this state for over 150 years.
Counsel, related to that, could you address a question regarding what you believe the original public meaning of the is of the clause that vests the executive power in the governor?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's the same clause in the Wisconsin Constitution as it is everywhere else. It's the Take Care Clause, the clause that vests in the executive, and in this case the governor, the responsibility and authority to take care so that the laws be faithfully executed. And you can look around the country at state Supreme Courts, state constitutions, even states that have constitutions that look like Wisconsin's, that have a separate constitutional provision for an attorney general and other subordinate executive officers. And those states, the Supreme Court, when they have addressed similar questions to what faces this court today, have said and held that the textual authority for the power to enforce the law is found in that Take Care Clause. There isn't anywhere else you can look in the Constitution that vests anything similar anywhere else that is as core an executive power as it gets in the Constitution, and it is the feature of the Constitution that allows the legislature to focus on what it can do and draws a bright line right down the middle in the separation of powers and says what it cannot do is arrogate to itself other powers. Just as much as the legislature cannot take away the judiciary's power to say what the law is, it cannot take away the executive's power to enforce the law.
Counsel, just to follow.
Air clause, is there an obligation to defend the constitutionality of state statutes?
I think there is to some extent, no less, Chief Justice Rogensack, than there would be for the Attorney General or the executive to defend the constitutionality of a federal statute. But, of course, as we've seen, it happens with some regularity that the executive branch refuses or declines to defend the constitutionality of a statute. I think that is a perfectly legitimate concern, a problem that every state faces and that the United States faces as well. But the solution is not to breach that core separation, that core distinction between enforcement and making laws. The solution is something that we've already seen happen time and again, both within this state and outside. And that is for the legislature to intervene as the legislature, not as the state. And this is true in the federal system as well. When Congress intervenes, as it has done on multiple occasions, it is intervening to defend the constitutionality of a statute as itself, as the legislature. But that is fundamentally different from saying in either a statute or anywhere else, we are intervening to represent the state. Because it is that power, who represents the state in enforcing the law, that is reserved exclusively to the executive branch.
Even when the executive does not want to go forward with that power?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. But there's a solution. We've already seen it. And we've seen it not just outside.
Oh, that they can hire outside counsel to.
They can hire outside counsel.
Absolutely.
Exactly right. They can do it themselves. They can figure out how they want to do it. But what they can't do is convert what is the executive's authority into their own authority to enforce the law.
Counsel, I just want to follow up on my question, because I didn't quite, at least to my satisfaction, feel like you made the textual connection for me. And I just want you to hit that head on. We've got a text that vests the executive power in a governor, a text that tells the governor, you make sure the laws are faithfully executed. We've got a constitution that has other officers, like the Secretary of State, the Superintendent, the Attorney General, who you're contending exercise executive powers. Can you just make the connection between those things for me?
Yes, and in fact, Justice Hagedorn, you made this point at the very beginning of the argument. If you go back to the founding, back in 1847 or 1848, the early commentators recognized they were creating what they called an administrative section of the Constitution. But every one of those officers, they said, and I'm just going to quote the language, the subordinate executive, or as they are called, administrative officers, are a Secretary of State, a Treasurer, and an Attorney General. So the founders understood that the Attorney General fell within this category of officer called subordinate executive. So the Attorney General frequently acts on behalf of the executive as the governor or the executive's main legal officer in enforcing the law. But of course, as we know, the Attorney General does not run free with this power. The Constitution vests and in the legislature a very important responsibility when it comes to the Attorney General. The legislature gets to prescribe the Attorney General's powers and duties by law, by statute. That is the role that the legislature has in this process.
Counsel, does that mean if the Attorney General is a subordinate, exercises subordinate executive authority, does that mean that the Attorney General must always take the position prescribed by the governor?
No, definitely not, Your Honor. And we've seen examples of this in this state.
How would you classify it as being subordinate if he can tell the governor no?
The title is subordinate, which means it falls within the executive. But, of course, there are many occasions where the Attorney General, either by statute or otherwise, exercises that authority in ways that conflicts with the governor.
I'm a little confused here. So you say the title is subordinate, but his authority is not.
The ultimate authority to enforce the law lies with the governor, and I think that's the.
But if the governor can't tell the Attorney General what positions to take, then that's.
Well, there is a practical give and take between the two. You don't have to look far to find examples where the Attorney General, either by statute or otherwise, has refused to defend or enforce a law to the satisfaction of the governor. And the governor then can step in and act in a way that, that he or she believes executes the law in the way according to his or her own constitutional
right.
obligation.
But doesn't that suggest to you then that the Attorney General's authority is not subordinate?
I'm a little concerned we're getting hung up on titles. I think when the founders used that term, subordinate, what they meant was the Attorney General falls within the executive branch and exercises...
But that's true only if it is true in fact, not just in titles. Right?
Well, I think that's true, but I think we have seen plenty of examples where the two positions have disagreed, which has led, for instance, the governor to hire his own counsel and prosecute a case where the Attorney General has not.
Right.
What can't...
You had mentioned you were going to talk about bicameralism and presentment.
Yes, Your Honor.
How about we do that?
Sure.
All right. So at page 32 of your brief, you say, as the U.S. Supreme Court has explained, any legislative action that has the purpose and effect of altering the legal rights, duties, and relations of persons must undergo bicameralism and presentment constitutional muster. Yeah?
Yes.
My question is how heavily you want to lean on that. And the reason I ask is this. Administrative rules alter the legal rights, duties, and relations of persons. But they are not subject to bicameralism and presentment.
So I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is I think the premise is wrong. I think administrative rules are subject to bicameralism and presentment.
How so?
Under Martinez, the legislature exercises oversight over those rules and at any point can overturn or suspend a rule and so long as that process goes through bicameralism and presentment.
But let's say they don't suspend it. The rule has the force of law. People can be fined and imprisoned for violating them, and they have never been presented to the legislature or to the governor.
Well, I think they are presented to the legislature and by extension the governor, but the legislature opts not to attempt to overturn those rules through bicameralism as presentment. But this, I think, gets me to my second response to Your Honor's question, which is that when agencies are exercising their rulemaking authority, although they are being delegated that authority by the legislature, their ability to promulgate rules is something less than pure legislative action. In other words, what bicameralism and presentment requires is that whenever the legislature acts, acts in a way that carries the force and effect of law, it must proceed through bicameralism and presentment. But that isn't necessarily true for other aspects of essentially lawmaking, where an agency is doing it instead of the legislature.
Yes, but I don't see where that is allowed by the Constitution. Right. So when the legislature makes a law, it has to go through bicameralism and presentment. It then says, hey, I've got a good idea. How about we create an administrative agency, and it will create things that have the force of law that don't have to go through bicameralism and presentment, unless we choose to make it so.
Sure. I mean, what Your Honor is articulating is, I think, a fair criticism of the administrative state, but it is not before this Court in this case.
Well, it is in this sense. Your concern is that the suspensions don't go through necessarily when there's multiple. They don't necessarily go through bicameralism and presentment, and therefore it is an illegitimate exercise of the legislative authority. But that rests alongside everyone's apparent agreement, perhaps not in the future, that the legislature can create something that has the force of law that never goes through bicameralism and presentment. So it's okay when they come into being, but it's not okay when they're suspended. Why is that?
Because the legislature itself is not doing the rulemaking. It's not the legislature that is promulgating rules and regulations.
Okay. Your argument would give superior power to the agencies.
Yes.
Legislature itself does not have. Logically, counsel, how can that be? How can the legislature be required to go through a lawmaking process to suspend a rule that was made through delegated legislative power when the agency itself has no such requirement?
That's exactly what this Court held in Martinez. Martinez, the framework in place under Martinez was a rulemaking process that did not itself need to go through bicameralism and presentment because it was not the legislature acting as legislature. And at the same time, if the legislature wanted to take a rule and overturn that rule, it could do that. But the only way this court said it could do that is if the process it implemented met bicameralism and presentment requirement.
But that assumes the existence of the problem identified by Justice Bradley, right? There you are, you're a subordinate, you're exercising delegated authority from the legislature, and it's okay that you create something with the rule that has the force of law without bicameralism and presentment. And so Martinez, doesn't it, just kind of accepts that as a given and then says, all right, so given that, what can the legislature do to suspend those rules? So I don't really read Martinez as signing off on the idea that it's just fine for the legislature to create an exercise of power that doesn't need to go through presentment and bicameralism.
I understand the concern, Justice Kelly. I do not think it's implicated here. At issue in this case, all we have when it comes to this particular provision is a law that attempts to remove the key and fundamental safeguard and check that this court in Martinez said was required whenever the legislature is going to overturn a rule. That's what Martinez held. It's at the first paragraph. It's at the very end of the decision. The only reason that rule suspension scheme was constitutionally allowed was because it met bicameralism and presentment requirements. There is no dispute in this case that the legislature's new approach here does not meet those same requirements. And so as a result, what you are left with is the ability of small legislative subcommittees to essentially police and run roughshod over the rules that agencies promulgate. Now, does the legislature have other solutions to this identified problem? Could it act in other ways to address, Justice Kelly, your concerns? Yes, it does. There's no dispute that were the legislature to want to take this step, it could eliminate an agency. If it believes that there is a defect in the way an agency is acting, either constitutionally or otherwise, proceeding through bicameralism and presentment processes, it could eliminate that agency. Or it could pass a law that eliminates any authority of the agency to act because it is so detailed and operates in such a way as to essentially eliminate any need for that agency.
Could it also say, administrative agency, if you wish to promulgate a rule, do so. However, it will not be enforceable until it is referred back to the legislature and the legislature adopts it through bicameralism.
I don't see any constitutional problem with that. And in many ways, I think that was what the approach in Martinez was designed to do. It gave...
How does that differ then from this?
Bicameralism and presentment, Your Honor. That is the key and fundamental safeguard and check that exists under the Wisconsin Constitution that says when the legislature is making law, it must proceed through these basic requirements.
Right. So under my hypothetical, there's no bicameralism or presentment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then I misunderstood.
So the legislature says to the administrative agency, go ahead and promulgate your rule, but it will not come into force until it is presented in the legislature and is adopted as a law. And so so there goes the administrative agency. It promulgates a rule, refers it to the legislature, and the legislature kills it in one of the houses. And it goes no further. There's no bicameralism or presentment there, right?
That scheme fails Martinez. I don't see any way to read Martinez, and I think this court could hardly have been clearer, that the only way the legislature can suspend or overturn an administrative rule is proceeding through bicameralism and presentment.
Yeah, so I'm asking you, my hypothetical is a little bit different. So this doesn't deal with suspension, it deals with the promulgation. So the legislature says, in order to promulgate an effective rule, you go through your process, but that's not the end. It has to come to the legislature, and the legislature has to adopt it, right?
Sure.
Could it do that?
I'm still trying to understand, and I hope I'm not through bicameralism and presentment, or no?
Yeah, so the rule would not go into effect until the legislature, through bicameralism,
yes,
and amendment adoption.
I don't see a constitutional problem with that hypothetical.
Okay. So how is that different from a suspension?
The suspension must go through bicameralism and presentment. Just
no, but only because we said so in Martinez. I'm looking for
but I mean, only because you said so in Martinez, but Martinez establishes the basic requirements for legislative action that carries the force of law. And it isn't just that it's established in Martinez. This is what the Constitution requires. So if under any hypothetical, if the legislature is acting in a way that carries the force, it can do a lot in its subcommittees, a lot. But if it's taking action that carries the force of law, the Constitution, as a basic matter, requires that it proceed through bicameralism and presentment.
Counsel, do you agree with General Call's argument regarding facial constitutionality and its application in this situation?
We do, Your Honor, and I think Gabler is the guidepost for this court and how to approach it.
Can you cite any cases that sort of frame it the way General Call did? I understand here's how we did it in Gabler, and to some extent, it's probably fair criticism that courts have not always been consistent in facial versus as applied. But is there any statement that sort of divides it the way
Say this. In Gabler, what this court said was there is a facial challenge, constitutional challenge can be brought, and I'm going to quote here, if one branch must, quote, account for the possibility, end quote, that another will impermissibly encroach on its independence. That was the test that this court used in Gabler to ascertain whether a facial challenge could be brought. And here, the possibility that there could be one application of one of these provisions that wouldn't run afoul of separation of powers is not enough to justify granting a motion to dismiss that raises a constitutional challenge to a facial way in which this statute attempts to convert executive power into legislative power. Another way to think about it, perhaps, if you had a claim that a company was employing a uniformly discriminatory rule, because you could find one person who wasn't discriminated against would not mean that a court would grant a motion to dismiss on the basis that it can't be a facial challenge to the policy. And I think what we have here is a set of laws that are designed to breach the bright line between how you make a law and how you enforce a law, and the possibility that down the road the legislature might do something within the scope of these laws that wouldn't violate that bright line is insufficient at this stage to justify granting what the legislative defendants would like this court to do.
On the rule suspensions, and I think Justice Ann Bradley raised this point earlier, but the governor, I think, took a different tack and argued in his brief that in fact, because a rule could be suspended a second time, doesn't, still theoretically has the presentment and bicameralism that would back end that would be enough to survive, a facial challenge. And I guess one of the pieces I just want to add on that, I mean, it seems to me that the reason we draw that distinction with respect to the Attorney General's arguments, even beyond standing, also has to do with judges not saying too much sometimes. We want to be a little careful about painting with a broad brush, and sometimes these things are better addressed when we have specific facts. And if there's legitimate ways it can be exercised, then we wait till some time where it's not legitimately exercised.
I see my time has expired.
You can answer his question.
Thank you, Chief Justice Robinson. Mm-hmm. So I think this court ought to be careful when it is attempting to decide a case narrowly that it not unnecessarily breach the core separation of powers principles that lie at the heart of this case. I would take this court back to what it said in 1932 in Whitman, which is, at least when it comes to the rule suspension provision, Justice Hagedorn, which is where you started your question, that a committee's power to disapprove rules or regulations is in practical effect the power to prescribe them. And so what we have is a scheme that is designed to hand small legislative subcommittees core executive power in ways that are unprecedented, not just in this state, but across the country. Before this court attempts to potentially duck the issue on whether this is a facial or as-applied challenge, I think it should take seriously what the potential consequences of that decision might do. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Well,
I thought counsel's introduction was helpful to our questions. Do you have a particular scope that we ought to be looking at, Attorney Pines?
I'm going to address the guidance documents matter. I'm not intending to talk about the Attorney General's powers, which I think have been covered quite thoroughly up to this point during the last 90 minutes. I am Lester Pines. I represent the governor of the state of Wisconsin. With me are my partners, Krista Westerberg and Tamara Packard, and my associate, Beauregard Patterson, who made invaluable contributions to the submissions of the court, and I want the court to recognize that. I appear not as a partisan in a political dispute between the governor and the legislature. I'm appearing as counsel for the governor. The governor was elected by the people of this state to oversee the executive branch, and who, like the justices of this court and like the members of the legislature, is sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of our state. Governor Evers asserted in his answer and in his cross-claim that certain statutes and amendments to statutes adopted in 217, Act 369 and 70 violate the separation of powers by infringing on the powers of the executive branch and, in some cases, the judicial branch. That was found in the cross-claim. Allegations that a statute violates the separation of powers where the governor or the judiciary is coming to court for a court to determine whether or not there is such a violation are extremely important. And this court does not have the merits of that claim before it. The court took a review of a motion to dismiss. And I think it's fair to say that based on the discussion that has happened over the last 90 minutes here, the complaint in this case has made sufficient allegations for it to go forward. Judge Remington's motion to dismiss, his decision on the motion to dismiss denying it, should be affirmed, and this matter must be sent back to the court for fact-finding. And there's only a very simple reason for that.
But that's only true if there is actually any legal merit in the claimed unconstitutionality, isn't it?
I'm not exactly sure, Your Honor, what you mean by legal merit. Because
right.
there were two allegations made in the complaint. One is that there is a core power that has been interfered with. And secondly, if on its face one cannot determine that a core power was interfered with, the next question is whether or not the legislation unduly burdens or substantially interferes with the operation of the executive branch.
So let's
that is a question of fact.
Let's take that in two steps then. So the first one, if we can clearly determine that something does not from the allegations of the complaint, we can clearly determine does not violate the separation of powers. That's something that we can decide, correct?
Without facts?
Yes.
No.
That gets to the second piece, right? So if we see there's no factual dispute here, it's a claim of law. You say X violates the separation of powers, and we can see without development of facts that it doesn't. We can decide that, yeah?
Well, you can't see that there's no, that is, this is not a motion for summary judgment. Mm-hmm. This is a motion to dismiss.
Right.
On the face of the complaint, there are facts that are alleged. The facts are, support the claim that there is an undue burden or substantial interference. This court, in three of its cases involving its own powers, did not decide those cases by merely looking at the face of the complaint.
Well, let's take a look at Section 35.
Okay.
No agency may seek deference in any proceeding based on the agency's interpretation of...
I'm sorry.
Section 35 says, No agency may seek deference in any proceeding based on the agency's interpretation of any law.
Okay.
So we actually said a couple terms ago that that is the state of the law. Do we need to develop facts to determine whether or not that section is a violation of the separation of powers?
Well, with regard to that, Your Honor, there may be factual issues that should be resolved.
Suggest
but
one.
But the question is not whether or not on a motion to dismiss, a court can go through this and say there haven't been sufficient allegations to support the elements of the complaint.
Well, the element of the complaint here is that Section 35 violates the separation of powers. Now, that seems to me to be a legal question that we can answer without the development of facts. Now, if I'm wrong, suggest a fact that we might need to know so that we can address whether Section 35 violates the separation of powers.
Well, Your Honor, with regard to that particular provision, we said in our brief that that particular item might be one that the court could dismiss, and we wait to see what happens with that.
Just might.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So suggest
I'm really here to talk to you about the guidance document provisions.
I know.
We can talk about the other provisions, but the court cannot avoid the guidance document provisions.
So I know. So this is a structural question, right? How do we address this case? It's here on a motion to dismiss, as you say. So what I'm interested in is, could you, are you telling me that you could conceive of some disputed fact that would say that Section 35, a mere recitation of what we said in Tetra Tech, could actually violate the separation of powers?
Now, the legislative defendants have conceded that because they answered the governor's cross-claim, which incorporated the entire complaint and made additional claims. They answered it. They didn't move to dismiss. It's still pending in the circuit court. It's not even before this court.
How about guidance documents?
Guidance documents. And I should say the guidance document provisions we have contended are an interference with the core power of the governor to give advice. And if you look at the words of the guidance documents, the guidance document provisions itself, you have to see how broad this definition is. First of all, guidance documents is a made-up term. The legislature decided to call something guidance documents. All right? Fine. They created this new statute that says guidance document. It's any formal or official document or communication issued by an agency, including a manual, handbook, directive, or informational bulletin. And I'm going to go to the second phrase here, that provides guidance or advice with respect to how the agency is likely to apply a statute, rule, or rule enforced or administered by the agency. The only branch of government that has the power to give advice is the executive branch.
Counsel, it seems from your brief that you agree with the sort of broad proposition of the legislative defendants with regard to we could do as applied versus facial, and maybe disagree with your counsel on that. So I want to know if you do, and then I guess my follow-up question is, it seems that I could come up with a whole host of pretty innocuous guidance documents. So, for example, the Medicaid handbook is functionally a guidance document. It is, sometimes people have argued portions of it are a rule, but it's something that they create, and so the new provisions basically say before you put that out there, you need to put it out there for notice and comment for a brief period of time. Now, that's maybe a bigger one, but there's all sorts of, I suppose, pamphlets or those sorts of things that that agencies might issue. Why is it problematic in at least some situations, or at least a situation, for the legislative branch to say, before you published material describing programs. You need to give the people who are subject to those programs an opportunity to weigh in.
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor, that you make reference to innocuous guidance documents, as they're defined. We have not put before the court the facts that we would like to put before the circuit court.
This is, so my assumption, of course, is whether this is facial or as applied.
Well,
obviously, if you're...
I think really the question about whether it's facial or as applied really begs the question of how a separation of powers case is to be decided. Because if you make an allegation that a core power is interfered with, and an allegation that there is substantial interference or undue burden, that if the court looks at the question and says, no, it's not a core power, there's some kind of overlap here, then by definition you have to go on then and look at the scope of the interference, the scope of the undue burden that has to be done factually. You can't look at it and say, okay, I'm going to look at this and say, all right, so here's a kind of guidance document under this vastly broad definition, which would include emails, videos, changes to websites, a whole host of things that administrative agencies do to advise the public about the law. You can't look at it and say, well, I can decide this case without having findings of fact. That's the
counsel. How can the constitutionality of enacted legislation depend on fact-finding? Because at any given point in time, right now, we have a Democrat holding the office of Attorney General, we have a Democrat holding the office of Governor, and we have a Republican-controlled legislature. So I would suspect that the evidence introduced by those various entities would be very different if those if different political parties held those offices. So how, again, can the constitutionality of these statutes be dependent on the evidence that partisan entities choose to present at a fact-finding hearing?
All right. First of all, the court has made clear in numerous decisions.
I know we have.
That
I may not disagree with. I may
that
not
that
agree with
have,
those decisions.
That facts have
counsel.
To be found on that question. So there have been Republican governors, and there have been Democratic governors. Governor Evers was elected in November. Governor Walker was in office for 8 years prior to that. The people who worked for Governor Walker are alive and well for the most part. They're subject to being engaged in discovery. The legislative defendants can produce a tremendous number of witnesses who could theoretically say, the facts don't, these guidance documents are nothing. We could do them like that. That's what fact-finding is about. And if, just as in the cases that this court has decided about its own power, there are findings of fact. For example, this court determined that on the guardian ad litem issue, that paying guardian ad litem a certain amount of money, you know, it's not that big of a deal. It doesn't interfere substantially interfere or unduly burden this court. The same thing with regard to the other matters that came before this court in the separation of powers questions. Just because there has to be fact-finding doesn't mean that it is an impediment to a decision on constitutionality, because the law in the state is there's two ways that a separation of powers infringement can be unconstitutional. One, it infringes a core power. Two, if there's some kind of interplay between the powers, the court has to examine the facts that underlie the claim that there's an undue burden or substantial interference. You can't look at a complaint and say, okay, on the basis of this complaint, which states a claim, under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, you can't look at the complaint and say, yeah, it doesn't substantially interfere,
does
it doesn't unduly burden.
Does the governor review guidance documents before? Does the governor review guidance documents from the agencies before or at the time they're put out?
The governor personally, no, but the governor appoints cabinet secretaries who administer the agencies, who appoint deputies, and assistant deputies, and appoint all of the division administrators. So the governor is in administrative control of the agencies, but he does not personally give the advice, but his advice is given through the agencies. And in fact, the statutes contemplate that the administrative agencies shall be consolidated into a reasonable number of departments and agencies consistent with the executive capacity to administer at all levels. That's 15.001 sub 2 sub B. Clearly, the governor is in charge of the administrative agency for the purpose of giving advice to the public. We've got simple advice. Click it or tick it.
The parties have been relying
we
extensively.
We have complicated advice.
Counsel, the parties have been relying extensively on the Martinez decision. How do you square your argument with the pronouncement in Martinez that we have long recognized that administrative agencies are creations of the legislature and that they can exercise only those powers granted by the legislature?
That is an excellent question, Justice Bradley. And the administrative agencies, as Whitman said, is where advice is given. The legislature does not have the power to give advice. Consequently, the legislature has not given the employees of administrative agencies the power to give advice. The power comes from the governor, who is the chief executive, who supervises the administrative agencies and uses the administrative agencies to see that the laws are faithfully executed. There's two ways that the laws are faithfully executed. One is to get people to comply with the laws, and the other is to enforce the laws. To get people to comply with the law, you tell people what the law is, you advise them about the law, and then they comply with the law. If they don't comply with the law, you enforce the law. That's how the laws are faithfully executed.
Counsel, before your time is out, I want you to address the presumption of constitutionality vis-a-vis the guidance documents or any other.
Well, the presumption of constitutionality, if this court says that there's a presumption of constitutionality that the governor has to overcome when the legislation is substantially interfering or unduly burdening his ability to advise the public or exercising a core power, then you would be giving the legislature an advantage here. And, you know, we have three co-equal branches of government. So I think the way to look at this is, and what the legislative defendant's position is we've got all animals are equal. But some animals are more equal than others. Remember this from Animal Farm? The legislature's position is we've got three equal branches of government. Only one is more equal than the others.
Is it your position in this type of a challenge that the presumption of constitutionality does not apply?
That's correct, because it is not just the legislature that is presumed to be acting constitutionally. It is also the governor who is presumed to be acting constitutionally when he says the legislature has interfered with my authority. That's why the governor is allowed to make these kinds of claims. That's why the judiciary is allowed to do that.
And what authority do you cite for that premise that the presumption of constitutionality does not apply in this type of an action?
Well, if you look at Babler, Babler, however it's pronounced.
What are those lures?
Ahern. If you look at that case, which is a seminal case, this court looked at that statute and says, hey, you can't do that to us. You can't have a legislation which says a commission can oversee what we do. And the court didn't say, well, we presume that legislation is constitutional. Therefore, we can't overcome that presumption of constitutionality. You just said, no, that was passed. And I guess the implication in Babler was, beyond a reasonable doubt, we've decided that your statute is unconstitutional.
And we did that without fact-finding, counsel, didn't we?
You did that without fact-finding because you said it was a core power. But in the other cases, the state versus two unnamed defendants, and in Friedrich, and in Holmes, you did fact-finding, and you said, well, we've looked at the statute, and the statute doesn't substantially interfere on burden or unduly burden our power. That's how you did this with your own authority.
Counsel, just getting back to the core question here, it seems to me the legislature can obviously tell the executive, set the policy for the state, right? Why isn't the legislative power also telling the executive how to go about carrying out its executive authority? It seems that the legislature does that all the time and that this is one of those things. Now, admittedly, let's assume, take for the sake of argument, you're correct that it creates some real messes. But why, as a general proposition, is that not within the legislature's power?
As a general proposition, the legislature can do that. For example, the legislature could say advice should be given in multiple languages, Spanish and English. All right? That probably is not an enactment that would unduly burden or substantially interfere. But we've got to look at what this statute does. And we've got to look at what the employees of the executive branch do on a daily basis, and how hugely this statute interferes with the ability to give advice. And because the facts that show that are not before this court, the court cannot, on a motion to dismiss, determine whether that substantial interference or undue burden exists. It didn't do it in two unnamed defendants. It didn't do it in Friedrich. It didn't do it in Holmes. And it can't do it to the governor now. He has the right to have this claim fully heard, fully vetted, fully decided, and it may come back to you in the future, but it'll come back to you on a full factual record, which will allow you to determine whether or not a decision, maybe it'll be a decision against the governor, or maybe it'll be a decision for the governor, but you'll have a full factual record from which you can decide then whether the case has been made. But you cannot do this. You cannot reach the merits on this motion to dismiss. It's just not possible. You didn't do it for yourselves. You can't do it to the governor.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I began my presentation this morning by talking about the four categories of challenges here. And if I could have the court's indulgence for a couple minutes, I'd like to talk about how I think that the four categories here should be resolved, with bearing in mind Justice Hagedorn's point that sometimes it's better for the court not to say too much, not to reach out to decide more issues than are necessary. First, with regard to the intervention provisions, I pretty much, unless I heard wrong, the Attorney General pretty much conceded the intervention provisions are fine. The only thing, and I didn't really hear much of an argument otherwise, so I think it's fair to say that those are constitutional. The only thing I would say beyond that is that it would be important, I think.
Can you repeat yourself? It was hard to hear.
I apologize. With regard to the intervention provisions, the first category,
okay.
Unless I heard wrongly, the Attorney General, the arguably constitutionally affected officer, didn't really have any problem with those provisions. The only thing I would say further about that is I think it's important to make clear that those provisions are exactly the kind of provisions that the Supreme Court talked about.
I didn't hear him acquiesce in saying that the intervention could be on behalf of the state, though it was on behalf, and the text of the statute is on behalf of the legislature.
So that's obviously not a constitutional claim. The only thing I would say about how to phrase that, I think it's important if this Court agrees to say that the provisions here are exactly the kind of provisions that the U.S. Supreme Court said it was looking for in Bethune-Hill, so we don't end up with some nonsense argument down the line that we can't appeal cases to the U.S. Supreme Court when we have intervened in the federal courts, because of course in this court, the standing rules are much different than in the federal court. The thing about Bethune-Hill is it says the legislature needs to have the authority to litigate, to be able to appeal. The only thing I would say about the intervention provisions is we'd appreciate making clear that these provisions are exactly the kind that the Supreme Court talked about in Bethune-Hill. Now I'd like to spend more time talking about the provisions that really were the core of the fight here, which is the second category, which is Sections 30 and 26. I think it's pretty clear that those provisions are constitutional when applied to cases where the unconstitutionality of state law is being conceded. Both sections 30 and 26, contrary to the Attorney General's submission, do apply to those. You can look at the plain text there. They both have provisions for the JCLO in both 26 and 30. Both JCLO only applies with constitutional situations, so as applied there, they're constitutional. I also think it's pretty clear that they're constitutional when the public fisc is at issue. I heard the Attorney General say that Ahern, however you pronounce it, is distinguishable because there the public fisc is at issue. At least in some category of settlements that aren't to do with constitutionality, the public fisc is at issue. Maybe there are some as-applied challenges that could be brought if there's some injunction that says give a prisoner his shoes or give him, you know, a Koran or a Bible, where those two core legislative interests, constitutionality of state law and the public fisc, are not at issue. I would say that those could be left for another day for an as-applied challenge. And with regard to as-applied challenges, I think it's pretty clear that what the Attorney General here submitted is, frankly, invented out of whole cloth. There is no limitations on facial challenges like that. Gabler, I still bear the scars from the Gabler case, but I think that it is quite clear what the court was saying there was that every single application of the statute to any judge in the state, and it was a separate line in that statute that applies to judges, every single application of that statute, every single judge would be unconstitutional. In fact, I believe the attorney arguing for the state in that case argued that there were some applications that were less offensive to judges because they were only saying the judge did the wrong thing rather than sanctioning him in any powerful way. And this court emphatically rejected that and said every single application of the Gabler statute is unconstitutional, which is why it was okay to strike it down facially. There is no exception to the rule that facial challenges require an invalidity of every single application. And here we have two broad categories where these statutes are constitutional, and I do understand that there's concerns about some other application. I would submit if the legislature ever attempts to cause problems in a case where there are shoes or a Bible or something where those two interests are not an issue, an as-applied challenge can be brought then. With regard to the third category, when we're talking about these legislative review provisions, really this is a question of law. Either your honors agree with us that when a legislature issues a rule, when an agency issues a rule, when it changes capital security, when it enacts a new enterprise zone, that those are not legislation as such, as Martinez held, and therefore bicameral presentment is not required, or the court disagrees with us. If the court agrees with us on that, and we submit that the court should, under Martinez and Ahern, then the motion to dismiss should be granted on those. If the decision is the other way, then, you know, then there should be a judgment entered the other direction. But I would also say that if the court rejects our proposition there, it's undisputed that 40 years of laws where we've been using the same Joint Finance Committee structure in reliance on Martinez and Ahern would be thrown out the window. And I think that they haven't carried the very heavy burden to overturn stare decisis and 40 years of practice on those. And then finally, on the guidance documents. There was some conversation that I had with Justice Kelly about whether those are legislative or executive. I think the easiest way to solve that issue is that even if the guidance documents are seen as executive, of course the legislature can take away an agency's authority to make certain executive decisions. That is exactly what most laws do. They say, execute this law. Don't execute that law. Department of Corrections do this. Department of Natural Resources do that. So even if the court thinks those might be somehow executive, this is just the core power the legislature has over agencies, which is to give and take away their duties. And then just one footnote on this presumption of constitutionality. The argument that General Call made today about the presumption of constitutionality should not apply when two branches disagree. The Attorney General has made that argument before. In our appendix, we appended the brief the Attorney General submitted attacking the legislation in Martinez. There is several pages in that brief where the Attorney General makes the exact same argument. He said, here, I'm the Attorney General. I am attacking, on behalf of this agency, the constitutionality of these provisions. The legislature is defending it. Don't apply a presumption of constitutionality. This court applied a presumption of constitutionality, and, you know, I understand that some justices of this court have voiced concern about the presumption of constitutionality, but we do have stare decisis in the state. and they have not even attempted to show that they have met the high burden for overturning stare decisis.
Counsel, I want to ask just kind of a prudential question here. You know, one of the paths that you've given us is a narrow one. It is focusing on the facial challenge route. If we go that route, there's a lot that's unsettled, and there'll be a lot more fighting, which maybe is fine. Is there any merit? Should we consider the idea of providing more guidance simply to sort through these questions? I mean, these are obviously important questions that deal with the functioning of the two other branches of government, and do we have any duty to provide some level of additional clarity here? Or would you just prefer a more narrow route if that's how your client succeeds?
Two things on that, Your Honor. One is they're the masters of their complaint. They brought facial challenges. Surely we as a policy matter would prefer more guidance from the court so wouldn't have to expend the time litigating a new lawsuit. I suppose if the court did what I suggested and issued a facial decision, they would have a pretty quick lawsuit probably by the plaintiffs bringing some narrower as applied challenges. But that's the price you pay. And as this court's precedents make clear, facial challenges are adjudicated a certain kind of way. And the other thing I would say about is there is a wisdom in the facial versus as applied challenge rubric. The Chief Justice suggested that she might have concerns about some aspects of the intervention provisions with regard to construction of statutes. We have important responses on that we would give if a challenge were brought in that context. We would argue that sometimes a construction that narrows what this legislature said to a meaningless extent could be just as important as striking it down. My friends on the other side might have a different argument, but narrowing challenges in an as-applied context will focus the circuit court's inquiry and then the Court of Appeals inquiry and this court's inquiry. But of course, if Your Honors were to provide fulsome reasoning in rejecting these facial challenges, that would help frame any as-applied challenges that might be brought in the future, which I think might be a good middle ground between narrowly deciding the case and deciding all as-applied challenges that haven't been fully briefed or frankly brought in this case.
Counsel, in your initial comments, you made some reference to the Koshki case, which referenced also, as you indicated, some maybe ethical concerns. The attorney oath is, I will not counsel or maintain any suit or proceeding which shall appear to me to be unjust. What happens if the legislature does not approve a compromise or a settlement and the attorney general thinks that it is frivolous to maintain?
May I answer that?
Yes, you may.
It would be the same thing as happened under the prior regime, as if the governor, who had some authority to approve settlements, told the attorney general to continue the suit, that the attorney general didn't want to continue. As an officer of the court, I assume the attorney general would withdraw, just like
that's
he would have
the, that's
withdrawn.
That's the practical thing, but what does the words of the statute give the authority power, and of course we didn't get in to discuss the difference between authority and power here today, but there is a difference. But the text itself says legislative approval is required. You may answer that question and then
I'll
conclude.
Be brief. I agree that when you have two officers disagreeing in that, that could cause some practical problems. I would say that even if this court were to invalidate these provisions, you could have the same exact conflict and the same exact ethical issue if you had an attorney general and a governor who disagreed and the governor didn't want to approve that settlement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, this was really a very engaging argument. I congratulate you all. I mean, it's been 2 hours and we've been busy, all of us. The briefing was very good, a bit extensive, but very good nevertheless. So thank you for all of your efforts. We will now adjourn and reconvene at, gosh, I don't think that clock is working back there.
It is.
Really?
Five to four
it is. Okay, we'll reconvene at 4:30 in closed conference.
Thank you.